Segura show.
But also there's the question of do we let Samir, you know, instead of
do we introduce him
yeah,
first
introduce
and then get
him
into
and
it?
Then and then let him be here for that.
Yeah.
That's would be my vote.
Okay, let's do it.
Okay, and also just had a cold open.
No!
Here's a new theme song by 21's is easy. Like that.
Yeah, I feel like these theme song submissions are getting better and better.
They're incredible, but also ironically, we have a call to service for people because that actually literally depletes. I believe even if you sent in a shitty theme song, we've
No, I think Yusan actually does some filtering for us.
Well, if he has, then his filter is so extreme that we are now at the bottom. Like
yes, he said we're going to need more to replenish our coffers. But that one was wonderful, and it was by the SoundCloud user Vampire Legs.
Thank you, Vampire Legs, for your theme song. We have a guest this week or this episode.
Yes, writer and semi-good friend, Samir Gardaisi.
Hi, everyone.
I insisted that we introduce Samir because Jessica said she's got some shit she wants to talk about for, like, let's say 10 minutes.
10 minutes, okay.
And I was like, well, let's introduce Samir first so that Samir can pipe in if he wants to or at least feel involved. But
all right, Samir, not that you have a choice, but will you please indulge me in these 10 minutes I'm going to take?
I would love to.
Okay, great. Okay, so there's been this last episode, you know, we read an email from a guy who was like, hey, man, like, I went to China, and they're really racist to white people and black people, and it's like, okay, fucking duh. What's funny is he's not the first guy who's written in about, like, China and how people in China are racist. And then after that episode, this guy wrote in, hi, Dan and Jessica, I'm a 31-year-old white Norwegian man.
Wow, that's double white.
Yeah, that's double white. Not acknowledging race is problematic because the concept exists and affect people every day. I know that now.
Thank you. Thank you, Jessica.
I mean, both these first two sentences are real red flags. However, I think most people don't realize how much of a social construct race is. Oh, boy. Hold on to your hats,
well,
guys.
Well, let's not. Okay.
All right. All right, white guy. Race is not.
Dan, show your sides really quickly.
Well, I just don't want to mock a person who's on the side of, like, necessarily, like, the Roddenberry
dream. All right. Race is not a scientific term. Not because science is politically correct. It just doesn't describe anything accurate about human taxonomy. All humans alive today are the same species and subspecies, unless you consider the small amount of genes from Neanderthals and other human species found in Eurasians. The concept of race is based on a pseudoscience that was constructed to justify racism and slavery. And I think to use the term uncritically, unintentionally validates the belief that some have in eugenics. Also, do you want to...
This guy's got points.
All right.
He's numb me with his white splaining.
Yes,
so.
Okay. Here's the thing. Who cares? Like, what's your fucking point, because it's like... Okay, like, sure, like, that might be true scientifically, but what are
yes,
we talking
yes.
about? What's
Science
your
has not gotten us anywhere.
But also, what is your fucking point in bringing this up? Because race, like, as we know it, race, the social construct of race, is something that is systemic and anecdotally affects me every single day. It affects Samir every single fucking day of our lives. So, like, you theoretically bringing up the scientific, like, concept doesn't help anything. It doesn't add anything to us. And it directly... Yes, Harman,
I was drunk last week and we were talking about blackface and I was like, I listened back to it. And I'm like, come on, Harman, no, you're so close to making your point. But because we were talking about blackface, I'm like, no, I'm not defending blackface. What I was trying to say, and I'm drunk again, by the way, all I was trying to say was, I agree with every blockade that we put up. Like, when we go, like, don't do blackface, for instance, like, these are no-nos and things. I was drunkenly trying to get beyond that was like, but also let the lesson be known that simply not doing blackface and simply observing these cultural constructs that we've come to understand to be not offending each other is not the same as empathy. And so to the extent that this person, this Norwegian white person, is actually on the side of logic, and that tennis ball is on top of the net right now, and he could go either way with it. He can either go logically blah 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 blah, and he's going to end up either defending the status quo, or he's going to end up being in favor of progress.
Sure, yeah, because here's the thing. Sometimes the question isn't yes or no. Sometimes the question is why. Why bring this up?
I mean,
like,
yeah,
make this like the conversation to have when we're talking about race and representation?
If the answer is like Martin Luther King, you're going like, fucking race is a construct, so what the fuck are we doing? Why aren't we all hanging out together and assimilating and stuff? Then let's listen to those people. But I agree. Right now, the people that are saying race is a construct, mostly they're basically kind of saying, why do we have to change what we're changing? And the thing is, we haven't changed anything in 60 years.
It's also super easy for someone who is white, the whitest of whites,
right,
I would argue, and also a man, to at the top of the fucking power chain, to then say, like, what are we talking about here, guys? Race is a social construct. It's very easy for you to say when it doesn't fucking affect you the same way it affects other people.
That's a pretty good
argument.
So how
did I link into the Chinese thing?
Okay. Well, that was only half of his email, okay? That was only half of his email.
That's an interesting preamble.
Yeah. This is why I also said, I said, oh, Jessica,
no, we're only at 4.5 minutes.
Sorry. I'm sorry, I'm
Jessica, China is not a homogenous society. There's 56 officially recognized ethnic groups. You being a Mandarin-speaking Han Chinese means that you're kind of like a white person for China. You should be...
Wait, what?
Okay, well, what we're gonna get is, you should be able to feel some privilege when you visit, as you're a member of the biggest ethnic group in the world. Japan also has minorities, and they've all been treated horribly. I think the depiction of any country as homogenous is a disservice to minorities that will always exist everywhere.
Yeah. Well,
okay.
Fuck this guy.
Okay.
Fuck
yes.
Him.
So this is okay. Here's the thing. What a lot of guys have written in about like China and stuff. And what bothers me is the subtext, because subtext matters, as does context. So the underlying subtext of these guys who are 99% white guys. I think there was only one non-white guy who wrote in about China being racist to them. The subtext is
white.
Gotcha.
Right.
Like, basically, gotcha, Chinese lady. Like, if I get you to admit that China is racist, then
because you're Chinese.
Yeah, exactly. All of your arguments about racism in America are null and void, which is completely insane.
It's also racist.
Yes, it's also very racist because nobody is writing in asking Harmon to atone for Britain's racism. Like, no one has written that, and no one has been like, Harmon, I went to fucking Britain and they were really racist to me and black people. Like, that doesn't happen.
Well, I think also looking in context, right? I mean, the greatest slave trade was done by Western Europeans. So there's a reason why the Chinese participate in anti-blackness, because it's a global affair. You know, there's not enough black folks, African folks, etc., in China for them to be the most persecuted class, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So it's all coming from the West. So it's all about representation.
Right.
Yes. And also in the context of this podcast where we talk about representation in like American media, like that doesn't pertain to us. Also, like, America is the country of which I am a citizen and the country I live in. I haven't lived in China since I was fucking 8 years old. I don't answer for China. I very freely admit that Chinese people are racist. Like, but what's your fucking point, dude? Like, what is this gotcha? But going back to what he was saying about like the minority groups, there are like minority groups in China. But guess what? They're all Asian. So, like, what I mean by a homogenous society is like it's different in China than it is in America, in that me as an Asian American in America, people still don't treat me like I'm 100% American. Just exactly. Like, I mean, this guy's case in point, because you wrote to me asking me to atone for fucking China and not for America. Like, so that's what I mean when I say it's different.
It's kind of like I think that the prerequisite to come into this podcast, not that you can't come into this podcast if you're like a closeted white power person. If you're like a white nationalist and you don't know it yet, like maybe this podcast will help you discover it. Because these conversations may help you get around to going like, yeah, but white people. And you really got to unpack that and go like, do you truly believe that the point of America is ideological, or do you think that it's somehow genetic. It's great. The only good thing that we can say about the times we're going through right now is that it's time to have these conversations. I see on Twitter like people circling this shit that are 22 years old. They haven't even fucking thought about this shit yet, because you can see them with their high IQs, like they haven't gotten to the root of this thing yet. It's a real basic root, and it's a scary root to get to. It's, you really have to say to yourself, my country, 'tis of thee, is not owned more by me than by someone that just moved in next door. And that's, whoa, boy, what a bummer.
Yeah.
Whoa, wow, what a fucking bummer. You belong to the first country in the history of the planet that ever said, what if it was a fucking meritocracy, which means open borders, people coming in, you working for a living, and like trying to make a dollar. So if we want to go back on that, which I'm sure a lot of poor people do, it's like we got to start being honest about the real reason we're having these conversations.
Yeah. So what I will say to Lassa is why I think you should take a moment and examine your motivations for writing this email, writing the things.
Like,
you
what
did.
Do you want Jessica to admit that people that look like her are also racist?
Yeah. Like, what are your intentions? What are your motivations? What moved you to write these things? And like, really, be honest. Don't write into me and tell me. Like, just examine it. Have a conversation with yourself. Why did you do this? What were your intentions? What did you hope would happen?
And I truly say, because you may be 22.
Like, no, said he's 31.
I'm 4. Well, look. I was a dick 2 weeks ago. I'm growing every day, and so like truly, I say it without judgment. Like, have these conversations, because actually they're really valuable. And the truth is, having the conversations is not going to lead to a darker place than not having the conversations. Not having the conversations is going to result in you getting a fucking swastika tattoo.
But also, fuck off. So okay, that was exactly 10 minutes.
All right.
Did we just wide along? Is that how it works?
I think so.
Where's the buzzer?
Yeah. All right, Samir, now let's all pay attention to you for the rest of the episode. Okay, Samir, I hope you don't mind that I announce to everyone that you are Pakistani and you are Muslim.
Because
this is we actually like announce everyone's.
Is there gonna be a knock at the door?
We announce everyone's race on this podcast because it matters. But I also am just excited for you to talk about like Muslim representation in media.
Yeah, absolutely. No, thank you for identifying me. I'd like to.
Identifying me.
I love this. For those who you know, we put a star on his. It's a yellow.
No, it's a crescent moon.
Right.
Thank
I mean,
you.
It's a way. I made it look like a star. I'm bad at geometry.
Well, let's talk about Muslim representation, because it's interesting to me that now everyone is really excited and wanting to hear, you know, from the Muslim voice.
Because of my friend Kumail.
Yeah, 100%. But, you know, obviously times are different. And you know, the Trump Muslim ban, I think, galvanized the liberal community in a way which allowed so many voices to kind of, you know, spring through in a positive way. But at the same time, my thing has always been, you know, what is the agenda at play? You know, when something all of a sudden becomes really important overnight, is that genuine? And if it isn't genuine, how can you make an opportunity to get as much in as possible? So that's kind of the work that I've been doing recently in terms of representation play and just kind of empowering writers. And one of the things that I've put together most recently, and I'll just dive into the plug, are these writer notes.
Do you want to set the table real quick? Like, let's talk a little bit about, like, how you see the landscape of representation of Muslims and like what?
Well, the representation of Muslims is it's so complicated, because I think that people have an assumption of what that means, which is either you're South Asian Muslim or you're Middle Eastern Muslim. No one really likes to do the work to know that there are Black Muslims, there are Latino Muslims, you know, there are Native Muslims, and what does that mean? That doesn't fit within the framework of how I understand. It's a faith-based identity,
right.
And to a larger extent, it's a political identity. So you choose to be Muslim, whether it's culturally, whether it's religiously, etc.
Yeah.
So having said that, it's a strange thing to talk about Muslim representation, because And naturally speaking about it, I know it's a race game just because that's how America works. We see race first. Mm-hmm. And so I can talk about it from a South Asian, Middle Eastern perspective because I think that's probably a little bit more on the note of some of the conversations that are happening because I don't think anyone's really that interested in exploring Black Muslim stories, which is very unfortunate right. because they are the entrance of Islam into America through mm-hmm. the slave trade. So, you know, their connection to American identity is so much more stronger than South Asian or Middle Eastern Muslim identity that came, you know, yes, you know, some of the turn of the century, but most notably during brain drain during the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
I find it most notable that you left out Chinese Muslims. Mm.
The Uyghur community?
Yes. Yeah.
And don't forget about Cat Stevens, the white yeah. Muslim.
Dan and I want to be represented in this conversation.
Right, right.
But in other words, I mean, I think it is notable to say, like, look, we can play games all we want when we're, like, in the current climate when we say the word Muslim. Like, the bad guys kind of love it that, like, they can pussyfoot back and forth between that's a religion or that's a thing. But, like, we are talking about brown people. Like when we're talking about travel bans, we're talking about immigration and we're talking about terrorism, all this stuff. We're talking about fear of brown people. We're not really that scared
of Cat Stevens.
Religion. Like, we can't be scared of Rick and Morty or something on Nickelodeon or something. Like there's a lot of ideologies to be scared of. We're not genuinely scared of Islam. We're scared of the face of difference. We're scared of hats that look weird and stuff like that. So I just, yeah. I mean, it's refreshing to have that conversation. Go, like, really, it's a dog whistle, even though it's just a religion.
It is a dog whistle.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And it's represented in a way where we kind of look at Muslim identity as the other, right? What you don't know is what you eventually fear. And then obviously in the context of the war of terror, it only behooves people to distrust or fear Islam because that leads into a hate machine, which is very profitable. So it's all kind of, I mean, the way I look at it is the deck is stacked, you know, very neatly against, you know, communities of color. And it's difficult to kind of unpackage that and figure out, okay, what are we exactly saying when we talk about, okay, we want Muslim representation, and what are we saying when, you know, someone like, you know, someone from the conservative community says that, oh, we want Muslims out, you know? And I think that continuing to have those conversations through inner community spaces is so important because this is the most frustrating thing. Someone like me, my experience as a Pakistani Muslim is different than a Lebanese Muslim, is different than a Moroccan right. Muslim, and yet we're conflated and put in this big pot. You know, hey, accept your differences.
Which is crazy because Christianity includes David Koresh. It includes, like, Billy Graham. Christianity includes Stephen Colbert. It includes mm-hmm. Joseph Campbell. It includes myself, frankly. I get a kick out of the Christ myth and get power from it and all this stuff. It's unfair that you might necessarily be thinking of, like, the worst people. And I just want to clarify one thing because I referenced my friend Kumail because he's Pakistani, which is the first time I didn't pronounce the long A, Pakistani.
That's the Wisconsin.
Kumail, I get the impression, he doesn't get a huge kick out of talking about it that much because I get the impression that it may be hard, there may be blowback for him. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that he is way more secular, like, that's his upbringing, and he's not, yeah. That's how he was raised, but...
But he's also not currently practicing, too.
Exactly,
which,
so that's my question.
His background is also Ismaili, too, correct. It's not Sunni, but basically that's a persecuted group in Pakistan. So he comes from a minority group already within a minority, if that makes sense. So I can only imagine that, you know, very much shades his perspective of what it means to Muslim American.
Right. So it could be like he was a Jehovah's Witness or something like that. I don't want to raise red flags for people. I go, like, that's nothing like that. But what I wanted to ask was just, like, when, because of the conflations that happen, because white people in America can go, we're capable of going, like,
We don't know if Jewish means a race or a religion. We get confused by it. We don't know if Muslim means just brown people or it means that you're not allowed to have eggs on Wednesday morning. I just want to make as a point of clarity where you place yourself in terms of kind of devoutness, like you. You're practicing Muslim. You're not just like raised Muslim or like the equivalent of a guy who says, I went to Catholic school, but
Yeah. I mean, I would say that I'm practicing Muslim in the sense that it's something that is important to me on the faith side and something that I integrate into my life. But on top of that, I would say that I do accept its identity as a political identity as well, because I think that's part of the more interesting conversation going on is that you have a lot of young secular kids that grew up Muslim, but they don't pray, they eat pork, drink. It doesn't really matter to them, but they're throwing down because there is a movement happening, right? Because it's so important to voice yourself in this connectedness with some of the other marginalized groups that are happening right now.
Right, because if tomorrow somebody started throwing all the Christians in a lion's den, like, guess what? I'm going to wake up to my Stephen Colbert-ness and be like, yeah, I'm Christian. Okay, so I just wanted to place that on the map. Like you yeah. So continue.
Yeah. So, I mean, so looking at some of the things that are kind of out there right now, and I don't know, I feel like it's kind of coming into play, and these are my qualms with what I'm seeing right now. And I know some folks are doing different things, which I'm interested in seeing, and some things are in contention. Hopefully they'll kind of pull through. But I think that there is this natural story of what it means to be Muslim American as choosing two identities and to be accepted by denouncing your own Muslim identity to be a part of something else, which isn't necessarily, you know, a new invention, right? We see that in cross-cultural tales all the time. It's like, okay, my parents are this, but I was, you know, I grew up here. What side am I on? But hey, Mom and Dad, guess what? No, I'm this. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's limiting in so many different ways. You know, I've Master of None episode talking about Eid, saw that, and it was interesting, but I also feel like it doesn't always have to be like that. It doesn't always have to be like this or that. You're either super religious or you're not. And the dangerous thing about that dichotomy is that it falls into this good Muslim, bad Muslim dynamic. And the good Muslim being someone that's usually very secular, usually someone that's, you know, more than willing to kind of opt out of the conversation of what it means to be a political identity. And then also someone that, you know, is kind of down. Whereas the bad Muslim is inevitably someone that's practicing, someone that is, of course, you know, depicted as, you know, someone that has political aspirations that may be dangerous. And then lastly, of course, the most egregious form of that is being a terrorist. Neither are true realities in the normal existence of what it means to be a Muslim American, right? On one side, the good Muslim, there's no one just day to day fighting terrorism and saying like, oh gosh, I love America so much. That doesn't exist, right? And the flip side, I mean, like the whole entire radicalization of Muslims in this country, perhaps, yes, but I feel like it's the radicalization of young men, which I think is a common factor that we need to address aside from
God,
Muslim
amen.
Identity, et cetera.
Ain't fucking men. Yeah, I mean, isn't it like what a crazy, weird thing it is that in America, the biggest sin you can create is actually, it's not believing in God. It's just believing in a God that supersedes your belief in Coke and Pepsi. And so actually we'll come down on rednecks that believe in Jesus Christ if they believe in him so much that they'd rather talk to rattlesnakes than eat Lucky Charms. Mm-hmm. Like we will come down on the Amish. We'll come down on anybody who's devout to the point where they start to maybe have a conflict with some of the tenets of this giant Borg cube that we've decided as our country. And I'm not really shitting on it, I hear what you're saying being like yeah, the age of assimilation, mission accomplished, like we did it, we created a nation of immigrants and it was successful, we took over the planet. So does everyone who comes over here now do we still have to like become American to the extent that means that we every single tiny little bit of our culture goes into a garbage can, and now we have a vestige of our previous life that's like the complexion of our skin and a few photos in our wallet, but in all other regards we're just ashamed of what we were, the first part of the melting pot thing is actually that, you know, you have your shit that's like not American, and the anyways, sorry, I'm a little drunk.
But the assimilation thing, like, it only goes for people who are not from European backgrounds, because like in America, like St. Patrick's Day is a national holiday. Like, we love white European heritage. You know, we love our Oktoberfest. We love our St. Patrick's Day. Perhaps we just love drinking, but still, like, you know, you don't have that. Like, there's this expectation for anyone who's not white to assimilate. And if they, you know, if they still maintain any ties to their own culture and speak the language, then it's like, well, then you're not 100% American.
I mean, it's the greatest trick ever invented, is that come to this country, just play by our own rules, and we'll give you access to everything. Oh, wait, you aren't white. You were never meant to get access. And so I think that's some of the things that maybe the past generation, I can say, when it comes to my parents' generation, that was it. You come to this country, you see two things. You see Black folks being completely marginalized, Native folks being non-existent, and the Latinx community, same thing, right? Marginalized communities. And then you see the white communities, like, oh, picket fences, suburbia, I have a choice to make. What am I going to align myself with? And that is kind of the brain drain immigrant experience. I'm going to align myself to something where I can be safe, because I just left a country under certain circumstances, and I want to make sure that my children can lead an amazing life. So you continue to do that your whole entire life. You lose a lot of yourself, because that's the debt you're paying. It's like, hey, give up this, give up that, give up that. And then you eventually get to a point where you see the glass ceiling, where it's like, nope, you were never meant to get entrance. You are not allowed to be in the penthouse.
And if I could run so here I go, there's a tradition on our show, I'm going to run my racist white guy simulator. So I'm going, yeah, that's all fine and good theoretically, but what that leads to is a slippery slope where y'all come over here and y'all brown and y'all bring your brown gods, and like the Irish came over here and they just became me, and I'm Irish and I'm part Italian and my sister's Italian over, and I live in a fucking U-Haul, and I got my 80 guns, and I just want to say to that guy, I know that guy's not a listener, but it's that's not American culture. Like you're as much of an immigrant. Like, you look like a fucking alien to everyone in New York. Like, you live in a goddamn garbage can. And there is, it's, no one is saying that you're going to become worth less. It's just like, it's like, can't you, of all people who live under a fucking rock in the middle of nowhere, who keep tweeting me, stop talking about politics and go back to Rick and Morty because it's all I can do is lick moss off a fucking rock and watch your cartoons, like, and why are you more scared of people coming into the country when all those people are doing is like, they're gonna be on your side, they're fucking broke.
Do I answer another quarter? How does this work?
this idea that immigrants are the ones that are taking jobs from poor white people is, I wish there was a way to like pull that thermometer out of the mouth and like show it to them and go like, no, it's not immigrants that are taking your jobs.
Yeah, it's robots.
It's robots, and it's fucking
and capitalism. It's progress. it's progress.
It's actually
an evolutionary being. Like, you know, that's what it is.
It's not educating our children. It's a poorly run country. We got a lot of shit to get together. We got to fucking believe in this country. And the part of what we have to believe in is that the experiment has worked up until this point. And now we're getting a little tense. And the first thing we do is start pointing at each other and going like, well, you suck, and it's got to be your fault, right? I don't know.
Yeah, the model minority thing that you're talking about, which is like your parents' generation, you know, choosing like, oh, which side do I want to align with, like, I feel like that's a very, very Asian. Mm-hmm. And like, here's something that we should talk about, which is in America, like, when people say Asian, 99% of the time they're talking about East Asian, somebody like me, like Chinese, Japanese, Korean. But like, you know, Pakistan is part of Asia, like India is part of Asia. But
the
like,
hell you say?
It's just South Asia. But in America, when you say Asian, everyone thinks of me and not Samir, you know?
Right. Well, yeah.
And this is something that Samir and I talk about all the time. Right. East Asian versus South Asian.
And then when you go to the UK and predominantly most of Europe, Asian tends to be more my people.
Yeah, it means Pakistani, Indians, and Bangladeshi.
Right, and whereas you have to say Chinese to specifically...
Which is so crazy to me. So I lived in England, and like it's so weird because I knew that going into it, but I was like, well, then what do they call like my type of Asian? And then I found out if you're an older British person, you just say Oriental.
Shit. not to derail us, but I my makeup or hair or whatever was being done by a woman that was
watch it.
Can't wait.
She was primping me for a photo shoot, and she was Asian, and she was talking about how she still calls it the Orient.
Oh, how old was she?
She's probably older than you. I hope she's not listening, because she was delightful. But she's like, I understand that Oriental is, but she's like,
oh,
yeah,
but she's like, but I can refer to the place as the Orient.
She's like, I'm fucking Asian, and I can't refer to the Orient without my white friends yelling at me. So I don't know.
Yeah, well, you know. Yes, I've noticed that, like, in Asia, like, because they don't have the context of, right, like, all the racial politics that we have in America, like, a lot, like, people in Asia especially don't care about saying, like, Orient, because most of the time they're just looking up a direct translation when they're trying to say Eastern. And they're like, oh, Orient, that sounds good. But they don't have the context that we have.
But also, more importantly, you can teach everybody to say the right words to keep them out of getting in trouble. But you can't teach people, like, how to consider other people. Like we see different cheekbones, we see different eyes, we see different shades of skin. We grow, we get socialized as children. It's like, it should be okay when you're in your adulthood to go, you know what? I'm seeing you as different. Like I gotta catch up to this shit. We have to be able to have these conversations. So Samir, I like you were about to start plugging this thing that you're doing, which I find incredibly fascinating on a lot of levels. Can we get there now?
I like that you looked at me for permission.
She was like, let's go. Well, first of all,
wanted you to set the table a little bit and just talk about of like...
Well, before we go into that, I did want to talk about, the term Asian. And I also feel like, it is pretty strange that in the States, when we say Asian, we're undoubtedly referring to East Asians. But the frustrating thing is that I don't think that the terminology really exists for the regional identity for someone that looks like me. Because I feel like South Asian, it seems like a pretty new thing. Most people just say Indian, which I feel so, like that's equivalent of calling, you know, a Korean person Chinese. Like to assume that the predominant force...
You hate India, we get it.
That's what we're here to talk about, right? Okay. But yeah, I mean, like, I think that I appreciate when people, like, you know, yourself, I think in front of me, at least, you say East Asian, and you say South Asian, because I think, and they're Southeast Asian. And
then when I'm away from you, I'm like, those dirty brown people that I hate, who make the best dish in the world...
I guess there's the thing I'm wondering before we get into the thing you're plugging, which I think is an elegant solution and a proactive one in general. But when we talk about representation in writers' rooms, and we specifically talk about Muslim representation, which we rarely do. I mean, I think we sit here on this show, we talk about representation, and typically in my head, I'm picturing a black woman. I'm not picturing how can I get more Korean men in my writers' room. I'm not picturing transgender folks. I'm also not picturing Muslim men, like how to get them in the writers' room. I'm really focused as a white guy on like really specific definitions of diversity by default, and I'm like curious, like, because we kind of step around this bush a lot in this podcast, because we're talking about we talk about showrunners and their sensibilities and shows. And like if I'm doing Rick and Morty, which is a sci-fi show, it makes practical sense to me that like the more diverse voices I can get in my writer's room in ratio to the talent that they represent, the better. That's an easy luxury that I have, because I'm writing a sci-fi show. I'm writing a show about how, first of all, the tonality of that show has nothing to do with my experience as a white kid in Wisconsin or anything like that. We had a guy write in last week who was like, I'm white and I'm making this movie and with my friends about being a kid in Vermont, and do I have to put a black person in it? We're kind of like,
around to the conclusion of, like, no, make your white movie. Like, it would be probably more harm than good for you to bend over backwards to figure out how to put a black kid in your Sandlot movie. When it comes to TV, like sitcoms are still the foundation, and sitcoms are most often about if it's The Office, if it's a workplace comedy, it becomes more like sci-fi, where it's like, great, but your typical sitcom is like, oh, it's your family and it's this background and stuff. How do you feel about that? I'm a white showrunner. I sold a show that was based on my memory of being white in Illinois, and I'm staffing up my show. Am I supposed to, for the good of mankind, like, make sure that one of my writers has a name that sounds scary to me when I read it on the resume? And I go, like, oh shit, am I doing it? Or it, you know, it's I my mind kind of reels about that.
100% yes, and this is the reason why I think that there is this preciousness attached to a lot of showrunners, and specifically white showrunners, white men cishet showrunners, that their masterpiece will be tarnished if people that don't look and think and have their world views comes into the room.
Right.
And I would argue that actually quite the opposite. I think that you challenge the status quo and your view by bringing in another voice in there. On top of that, I mean, I think that this idea of, you know, yeah, like, this is, you know, a show about me growing up in, say, like, the 70s, and whether it's, like, you know, Vermont, etc., a very white story, you have to realize that folks of color have been watching white shows their whole entire life. You have taught us to write. So it's like that to me, it's like we probably know the show better than you do, just because that's the way we've been intaking it.
Well, but to with all due respect, though, you just said the complete, you know, you're like, absolutely, you need
two different
point of view.
Yeah,
and also, like, we can totally be robots and not have our point of view.
Well, I think that's the balance, though, of what it means to work on someone else's show.
You're saying you could use a little fucking, your show's not going to die from a little flavor. And also, by the way, we're not coming in as representatives of flavor. We're coming in as fucking pre-assimilated, pre-shrunk genes.
I think that they're coming in as writers and they say, hey, this is the show. I can write this show and move on from there. I mean, I understand that there, because I've been on shows where I was like the necessary insurance policy, and I know why I was hired, because if there wasn't a version of me, you wouldn't be able to do certain things.
Mm.
That's not necessarily the right way to go about it either, right?
Sure.
And so I think that
certainly doesn't make your job very easy.
Yeah.
you can't get specific about that.
Yeah.
You don't want to. Yeah.
I think that it has a lot to do with culture shift. I mean, it's a strange conversation to have, because I think that we localize it in the writer's room and it intensifies around this idea of story development. But it's really just like, I would just say, hey, who are your friends? Who do you hang out with? If it's only white dudes, that's a problem. That's just a liveliness problem versus something that has anything to do with your capacity to storytell. Because I think that one informs the other. And so I think to be an ally, to be a white ally, to be able to, you know, mentor young writers, emerging writers that don't have access and resources, and whether it's, you know, from a racial identity or a queer identity or a disability identity or all the intersections between, I think that just comes from, hey, like, I have access. I read something of yours. I think that you have something. You're going to be put into a situation that's very different than anything that you have experienced. I'm going to be there and be accountable to make sure that you feel safe until you strongly understand what your voice is in this room. And then, I mean, I think that's the greatest service you can do to any younger writers. And leading into part of the work that I'm doing, and the reason why I'm being, you know, I'm pontificating is that I've seen this work. I worked with 4 emerging writers. So, quick background story. I facilitated this writer's room called Break the Room in collaboration with Pop Culture Collab, which is a foundation that gave me some money. And I worked with this other nonprofit named Muslim Arc to bring emerging writers together in tandem with community leaders, organizers, and activists to sit down in a room together, a writer's room. So we weren't doing workshops, panels, or anything, like an actual functioning writer's room, to break story and write 6 episodes of a webisode series. These folks did not have any credits. They, you know, not all of them even had a television sample, actually, because I wanted to make sure that they brought their true voice and the voice that they felt comfortable with. These writers hit the ground running. And I say this just coming in with full bias, and this was admittedly my blind spot, I thought that, okay, the first 2 days is just going to be training because these folks just need to understand how to write. And boy, was I wrong.
Well,
on
yeah,
across
because,
the level.
By the way, every writer's room is a fucking clusterfuck. Like, it's not like a bunch of
that's
experts.
Probably true.
Yeah.
So, it's a little of, but I mean, the point being, though, is that trusting, I think, the brilliance of what a writer's room is, which is, hey, I'm going to, you know, let myself bleed and accept me as I am, and let's be vulnerable with one another. Combining that with this idea of writers of color working together, which means that we didn't have to play that game of like, okay, I got to be the spokesperson now, or so-and-so, you know, a co-EP said, you know, something that was problematic and a microaggression, got to deal with that.
Right.
Yeah. All of that was thrown out the window. We were allowed to be 100% creative.
Yeah, and that's you didn't have to devote part of 50% of your brain to police work and also to assimilation work.
But I'm really curious, like first of all, like, I would need 20 minutes to talk about, that's fucking brilliant. That's so sublimely brilliant, the idea of just like when we sit on this podcast and talk about how do we make a change for the better, how do we break the cycle, it's like you just fucking write something like it's whoever is funding this and did this, it's like NBC has diversity programs. It's like, oh, one person on every single show that NBC has is a person of color, ostensibly. That's like to have an entire writer's room and just go, yeah, we're going to go from start to finish. And you're going to walk out of here seasoned fucking writers, whether or not these scripts actually whatever gets done with them, which, by the way, is the industry norm.
Right.
It's the fucking industry norm. Right. The important thing is getting to a room and demystify this thing called writing. So anyways, I would take 20 minutes just sucking the dick of this idea. I think it's fucking brilliant. And I want to, but now I have questions about it that fascinate me, which is, you say, well, no, none of the people in that room have to deal with, for instance, the co-EP said something problematic, et cetera. However, what about on a root level? What about hierarchy? Are these folks that are filling this room, are they being given like titles? Like, so because different writers' rooms do like observe hierarchy in different ways.
So there was no hierarchy, and that's what I mean. Actually, in our grant, we specifically said we wanted to have a non-hierarchy system of what it meant to be writers in the room. Granted, I acted as a facilitator because we were working off my idea, and just because I came in with more experience with technique, not writing, I just want to be specific at that. I think that, you know, having more years of writing in a television room just makes you better at structure and technique, not a better writer, is, you know, what I believe. So there was no hierarchy, and it was interesting. I mean, it was more work. It was more work. I mean, it if something happened, we had to talk it through. But I felt like that's what we owed each other to get to the light at the end of the tunnel, because I've been in situations where I was just shut out. And usually it's done in a very passive-aggressive manner because we're all writers, right? Except for Jessica, who's aggressive-aggressive, right? I didn't want that. I felt that that'd be such a disservice to the writers.
You don't want to be a loud Chinese lady. Who wants to be that?
Oh, man, I'd love to see either of you try to be the loud Chinese lady in the room.
Who's apparently racist.
Here we go.
Make this pickle Asian. Ah, Jessica.
Wow.
I knew that was coming.
Where's
Miami?
I was
still so delighted.
Wait, does Dan know that about what do you think about that?
What?
What do you think about that? Your coined phrase.
Oh, no, he doesn't. No.
If we're getting Jessica dirt from 2012.
Well, it's like a button, I feel. Like everything that, so naturally, the way that our relationship works is that Jessica puts me down and I feel bad about myself. And she sees me feel bad about myself. And then after the put down, she'll say, what do you think about that? She usually turns her head too, because at this point she's walking way ahead of me, and I'm in tears.
My clearest first real memory of you, Samir and I had met because we both got our start at the Nickelodeon Writing Fellowship, but he did it the year before me. But we didn't, we only met each other like briefly. But it wasn't until years later that we were both asked to speak at a panel at the American Black Film Festival in Miami that we kind of hung out for like the 3 days of the film festival. And I remember this so distinctly because it just so cemented like who he was and who I was and how our dynamic was going to function, where we'd been like going to events all night, like in Miami, out in Miami. And then we were walking back to our hotel like at 3 a.m.
And Samir's like, I don't think these black people want to hear from us.
And like there's like no one out in the streets anymore, and we're walking and we stop at a crosswalk and it's a red light for us, and I'm like, there's no one here, so I just start crossing, and Samir stays on the sidewalk and he goes, no, Jessica, no, oh no. And he was so worried that something bad was gonna happen.
Oh, that's not a fair, even though Samir's owning his acquiescence, that's not a fair character. That's your perception.
But that's always been, but that was such a perfect encapsulation of our dynamic.
That's not even accurate,
person, right?
Is it? Samir, that's not
I
accurate.
Honestly don't remember, but it could be accurate.
I'm guessing that if I went back through a portal, what it would look like is what if I had been with Jessica, it would be like I would just be standing there. It's not the same as going, no, Jessica.
No, he was very worried and he voiced it. He was like, no, oh no. Because I remember him just saying, oh no, oh no, like in such a worried voice.
You're engaging in the millennia old stereotype of the emasculated Pakistani male.
Right, yeah. Stop desexualizing me.
You know what, Samir? Stop playing into the stereotype.
Okay.
Oh, take responsibility.
Maybe that. I have often watched my friends proceed across a crosswalk, and I have been like, fuck you, Cool Hand Luke. Like it says don't walk, and you don't know why. Like,
it was 3 in the morning.
SUV could come through at 80 miles
an hour. There was no one there.
Well, whatever. You know, assimilate. we should take a break, and then we want to hear more about breaking the room.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. And we're back.
And we're back.
Yeah, we were just talking with Samir about his, he's got a 2-year-old kid. And, we want to talk about this. It's called Breaking the Room.
Break the Room.
Break the Room. This just seems like such an elegantly brilliant thing. So I want to hear more about it. I particularly want to understand like where the money comes from to make it happen. Because, and it's not because I'm like sea lioning it, it's because I want to replicate
this. Yeah, well, because everybody who participates, do they get, is it a paid position? Okay.
Yeah, so here's the thing, and I think that this is something I thought about extensively, was that what really allows people to feel that they're part of the process? I mean, writers, you know, when we do something on spec, you know, hoping to sell something or whether we're building up a pitch, I mean, it's thankless work. And sometimes that work goes on for 6 months and it's a no, door closes, you move on.
And the whole time you're in your bathrobe, your cat's licking its balls, like you feel not a writer.
Yeah.
Like if, especially if your ambition is to work in TV.
Yeah, completely. And so we were able to arrange a way, and it's not a lot of money, and these people are not guild writers, to be able to pay them because that was the right thing to do. And we're only doing a week, right? So it's something that is somewhat feasible. So it was just a foundation money that we did kind of back and forth, and we were able to talk it out and say, hey, this is going to be, you know, the right amount of money to make this work. We did it twice, actually. So the second one was done through another foundation. That wasn't a Break the Room, because Break the Room is specifically about inclusion and narrative shifts, trying to get all folks of different backgrounds to be in the same place at the same time, and also the community organizers and activists aspect of it. The second room I did was just a Muslim writers room, and that was something that was kind of my, I wanted that to happen because I felt, part of me just would feel so sad if I didn't ever get to be in a room with the identity that I have decided to choose. And so it was getting, you know, writers that I know that are Muslim writers that I either have read about or have, you know, met. And we came together and we did the same thing 1 week. Work on a webisode series, and we're finishing up that, not the actual writer's room phase, but finishing up the actual scripts for that this week.
So now this one, sorry, when you said you worked for a week, did you say you did 6 webisodes?
Yes.
In a week?
Yes.
I mean, okay.
Maybe you need to start hiring some Muslim writers for Rick and Morty.
Now I know not to hire Muslim writers because they're going to wonder why I'm so lazy. but in all seriousness, like it's just like it makes me wonder. Like in a week, and you're doing six episodes.
Yeah. So I mean, so the thing is that we get to a place where we because it's serialized, so everything is outlined. Not everything may get to scripts. So the last one, I think we actually were able to get four scripts out. So there are two remaining. But I put that work onto me because I don't mind doing the extra load. But it's enough for the reason of convening in the first place. So we do all the work that's necessary in the room capacity and finish it off like that. And well, but we're doing, I mean, it's a do or die situation, though. So if we could get money for 2 weeks, of course, yes.
Right.
But
that's an important part of the process is having that pressure and going like, oh, we have a goal here and we got to work on a clock. And because it's like this tightrope of between industry and art. I mean, you're being paid to apply the Henry Ford principle to the least Henry Ford thing in the world, which is to share of yourself with all these people. Does it defeat the purpose if a white guy comes in and talks about story breaking and
yes,
it does defeat the purpose.
Yeah, it does defeat the purpose because I think that one takeaway, because I did exit interviews with everyone, was that across the board, there was no white man in the room, and there was magic in that.
All right, fine. I'm gonna do an all white break the room.
Oh, so you're just gonna have a regular room? Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
It's gonna be called the Nazi.
Yeah, it's gonna be called a CBS TV show.
But I think that, I think that there's something important to that, though, because I think that allows us, because we're not saying like, oh, we're never going to work with white people. That's ridiculous.
No, of course, yeah.
But the idea is that,
of course you're going to work with white people. We own everything.
But it's about just having a safe space so you have, so you have the room to breathe and like really spread your wings a little bit.
And how amazing is it to take risks at the beginning of your career, right? Because that really defines your voice. And that was the gratifying moments where someone's like, no, actually, this is what I believe in, and I'm going to fight for it, which if I did, in a traditional room years ago, I know that I'd be brought into, the office.
It's safe because no one in that room is going to look at you and be like, what a nagging PC police.
Right. And the reason it's important to experience that is not because you're then going to go out into a world where you get fired for that necessarily. It's because feeling yourself doing that and waking up the next morning alive will actually empower you to, because we've talked to a handful of writers on this show, and what I'm really glad I haven't heard a lot of is people saying, well, it's hard being a person of color in the writer's room because you don't want to be a nuisance. I mean, we've heard about that effect, but by and large, the people that have come on the show have been like, yeah, but what are you going to do? You got to fucking do it. Like, the successful people are the people that are like, look, I know the role I'm playing in your white life as a showrunner by being the person of color that's once again picking this knit. However, I'm fucking picking it.
Yeah. I mean, you can be the kind of person who says, this is unfair and it sucks, and just stop there. Or you can be the kind of person who says, this is unfair and it sucks, and this is what I'm going to do to survive.
Right. Like, Jessica and my origin story is that she was on our show and was like definitely picking that knit, was like, there was made no subtle point about how she felt about whether or not a character should be Asian and whatever the fuck you were talking about.
clearly made a huge impact. Yeah.
but the thing that changes everything is that we both had a conversation about it numerous times, and we didn't end up like throwing coffee cups at each other or firing each other or like going like, well, it's like, it's the conversation that's important, and which is probably why. Yeah,
it's the conversation that bore this podcast.
It's good to demystify what writers do in a writer's room is like, it's, I don't want to say it's garbage, but it's what it isn't is there's no no one has perfected it. So like the more people that can experience how it works for 6 to 8 hours at a time, there's no way that's not a service to everybody. Like, because, which is why I'm so enamored by this, because I just feel like that should just be, there should just that program should be incredibly widespread and maybe it, like definitely for the disenfranchised, but also for the entire human race, like to experience. This is what a writer does in television. Like, had a bad day today? Oh, imagine five of those a day. Like, and don't blame it on your boss is this or your boss is that. Like, that's going to be a whole other thing. Mm-hmm. Like, now, first of all, think about spending 8 hours a day in perpetual confusion, in a perpetual state of not knowing what to do, and how frustrating that is. Did you like that? All right. Now here's your Harry Potter scar, and like whether or not you'll ever make any money doing this, you're a writer.
Yeah. What's really wonderful about this about Break the Room is that people of color get to experience what like a straight white cisgendered guy gets to experience all the time when he works, which is
supremacy.
Yes, of course. Which is just feeling so safe in a room that you are free to just use 100%
to
focus on your job.
What a shitty job it is.
Yes, instead of everything else.
Instead
you know?
Of being an ambassador. Yeah, I've said that. It's like I can imagine being a fucking ambassador to anything in addition to how shitty that job is.
Yeah.
So.
Selling the job to you guys out there?
Writing
is tough.
Let's actually unsell it to some of the shitheads.
Yes, I agree 100%.
Because guess what? There's a lot of firefighters out there, and they aren't discouraged by hearing other firefighters say, yeah, it's really hot and my skin blistered and I almost died. Like there are people who continue to go, yeah, it sounds like my job. But how do we support the, if I'm white and I don't want to interrupt and come in and tell everybody how to break a story and according to my patented story model, who do I Venmo?
Well, we're definitely going to try to do it again, and I can't announce the good news, but it did get picked up by a production company that's willing to fund it, and it's a sizable name where that's the validation we needed, because now we have not only said, hey, we can take money outside of the studio system. We can bring writers together outside of the studio system. We can do a process that doesn't match anything, you know, remotely close to the studio system, and we can sell it too.
You also get to teach that first generation of writers another important thing about being a TV writer, which is unemployment.
Right.
And wondering why. What the fuck did I do wrong? I gave them a hit. Why am I waiting tables again? You're obviously not.
The goal is, I mean, this is what I want from this, is that imagine being able to sell something and just function outside of Hollywood and say, hey, we're going to do the same writer's room again. Mm-hmm. And hopefully they can be paid guild salaries.
Right.
And
is it the same people?
I would love for it to be the same people. So what's happening right now is that it's not going to be redeveloped. It's going to be produced. I wanted to make sure that IP still was in my hands, and then we can figure that out later if it wants to be redeveloped. But right now, I think that it's important for the writers to know that, hey, they worked on something that's going to get made.
Mm-hmm. So honestly, without betraying anything or compromising yourself, is there any way that people listening, like, I want to lend five white dollars to...
Yeah.
A lot of our listeners are... white guys that are taking advantage of my hobby of not being racist to see if I'll read their screenplay. And I think I can get them to, like, donate money to...
Yeah. Nothing immediately now, which is probably poor timing on my part, but for
this
sure I will reach
un-Asian
out to you.
Of you.
I know, very un-Asian
of you. I've not thought out a way to make money.
The goal is to continue to do this, so you can follow me at Samir Gardezi. I always post about issues of diversity, etc. If it's not Break the Room, it'll be another initiative I'm working on. And I'd love to just have the conversation going, because I agree with you. The inclusivity aspect of the writer's room is so important, and that's what I'm doing. But like, get anyone, get, you know, CEOs and do a writer's room. I think that it's going to be the most performative, life-changing experience you'd ever have, because it really undrapes you, you know, in a lot of ways, and forces you to really just look at yourself in the mirror. And that's the beauty of writing, but also the misery of writing.
Right, because in the context of a TV writer's room, maybe not in the context of a hospital or whatever, but in the context of a TV writer's room, to me, meaningful diversity doesn't mean that your cheekbones are different and the amount of melanin in your skin is different, because you could have that and have gone to Harvard and to have parents that told you you were supposed to write in television, it actually means anybody who might have otherwise not thought of themselves as a potential TV writer, any one of whom might actually create the next Breaking Bad, like, or the next piece of shit that's like absolutely mm-hmm. successful, or like anything. Like, TV is not religion; it is it's medicine, and it's like it. I wish we could make it less of a mystical profession where, oh, you have to have 16 years of a support system in order to pursue this and stuff. Or at the very least, what I like about this program is that people could like take part in it and go, yeah, this job sucks. I spent like 8 days like...
White people can have this.
People with Asperger's can have this. I thought it was different. You know, I wish somebody had done that to me with journalism before I had to drop out of college. This is what it's like to work at a newspaper. It means being part of a lie.
Okay.
Anyways.
Another thing I wanted to ask you about is because I feel like you're very vocal about the trope of, in media, brown men whose trophy is white women.
Do we have another episode to talk about this as well? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is coming from a place of seeing those that have been most vocal about it and the group that's being affected, which is South Asian women and people that don't fit within the standard kind of South Asian umbrella of being, you know, cis or heteronormative. Yeah, it's awful. And it feels like Hollywood has just said, yep, we're going to do this for about 3 years and just, you know, see where it goes.
See a bunch of South Asian men who get to tell their own stories, but their story involves them pursuing and ultimately winning the affections of a white woman.
Which, love who you love. Do not give a shit about that. But
you
at
were
the expense
very
of
disappointed when I told you I was dating a white man.
Munir was more upset.
That's true. Samira's wife, Munir, was a very... It was like she went into a period of mourning.
Where did you guys meet, you and your wife?
So she went to UCLA and I went to USC. And so it was both their final
year. It
was
a real Capulet and Montague situation.
But yeah, it's a sad trope because, I mean, like, you know, I know Kumail is your friend, but like there is a visual in that movie where he literally burns pictures of South Asian women. And that is, you know, a
haven't
very...
haven't seen it. Oh. So much for friendship.
Oh, man.
I am your Pakistani friend now.
I just started high-roading him. Here's the reason it's not because I'm petty, Kumail. It's because I'm woke. No, I haven't seen it because I'm fucking lazy and whatever. It's not derailed podcast.
But I mean, there's been enough of a trend where that seems to be the lasting the lasting image in your head is that, okay, in order to assimilate, I have to attach myself as close as possible to whiteness, and that means disassociating myself with this other stuff. And again, like, you know, the people that get it the worst are South Asian women.
Right. What about this as a white guy?
That is your function on the
choice,
podcast.
You don't have a choice. But just like the tradition of conquering borders, of conquering boundaries, of conquering hatred through the well-worn trope of the Romeo and Juliet thing, where you make one thing the Montagues and one thing the Capulets, is, I mean, what can everyone relate to more than a person that is the other wanting to fuck a person that's supposed to be the other? And then you go, you walk out of the theater ostensibly going, it would appear that the boundaries between us don't mean as much. Whereas it's just a matter of scope where we go, oh, I wish that we had more movies about two brown people falling in love.
No, not necessarily. I think the issue is that it always interracial, how we look at interracial relationships is that, hey, one person of color with the white person.
Yeah.
Why couldn't it have been, you know, a Latino, you know, guy? Like, it could be so many different other combinations.
I know you're not saying why couldn't Kumail's story have been about guy.
Because even a Master of None, the whole second season, the arc is that he's pursuing this white woman.
Right, but I mean, yeah, I think we're all on the same page because mm-hmm. no one here is saying only, one thing
yeah,
has
no one,
to.
Sure, I'm not, I'm, no one's saying only date
yeah,
within your
I'm not
race.
Decreeing, although my mom would sit on the end of my bed when in the 80s, and like my mom's like vision of race is kind of the one I hold on to as a white guy, which is like my mom basically said, look. You know, one of these days, everybody's just going to fuck each other and we're all going to have kids that look the same and then it'll all be fine.
Your mom said the same. Yeah. You sat on the end of your bed. And
well, my mom would come into my bedroom. My mom came into my bedroom at one point and said, people are going to say something called the Holocaust never happened. It did.
That was your bedtime story?
My woke mom, like preparing me, by fucking me up. But I do hold on to that. And I also recognize that that's not... I don't want everyone who looks different from each other to all fuck each other because probably I'm going to guess white people are going to win.
here's the thing. It's like, yes, of course, like Kumail should tell his own story. And this is a true story of how he and his wife got together. But am I correct in saying that what you're saying is he could have told the story in a way that didn't put down brown women?
Right.
Yeah, that absolutely. And secondly, just kind of as a South Asian community, being conscious about the stories that we're throwing into the ether. I want to say it felt like there were six or seven things, whether it was a television episode or a feature film, which had enough where people say, like, okay, this is getting really old. We should probably figure this shit out because this isn't always the reality. And that's kind of an inner conversation, of course, we have to have as a South Asian community. But I think that it comes from this idea of assimilation. I think it comes from this, again, model minority, proximity to whiteness.
Right.
Not to say that that's, you know, that was Kumail's like agenda. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that that is the umbrella of all of this. And to deny that would be absolutely
right.
absurd.
So now, yeah, let's be aware of it so that neuroplasticity can happen. But it's very interesting now that you mention that because it's like we have a long-standing tradition in this country of like not letting black men do it with white women, like period. I mean, we supposedly got over that like with historical things in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, blah blah blah. But the truth is, we just don't fucking put up with it. Like it just doesn't happen that often.
Right.
Like the movie has to be called like Jungle Time. Like in order for the movie has to be all about how he's black.
Right.
And she's white.
Right. It's well, like
I was gonna say no. I think that's that's. I'm
and likewise with
up.
Asian men and white women, and so when you said proximity to, that's the thing, is like, are we actually reaching out to brown men and saying, hey, you're kind of just Italian. Come on, come in.
Similar. Yeah, I think that the reason why South Asian men, again, going into model minority, also non-threatening, those are the reasons why I think that it's acceptable to see these interracial relationships, you know, whether it's a white guy with an Asian woman because that's like, you know, the exoticness, or again, a South Asian man with a white woman. But I feel like the history of America when it comes to blackness, the polarity of it, no, I mean, black folks were lynched, you know, for even looking at white women at times. And, you know, so that is an entirely different conversation that we also have to be cognizant
and
about.
And it's weird that these are boundaries that we're not so keen to conquer, that we'd rather do a movie where everyone's black and consider that a triumph, that we're not really into the whole let's pair each other up. And so and I'm kind of curious because of how this goes into religion, because you and your wife, you met in Southern California colleges. You're young people. You weren't from the same town in Pakistan, I assume. Mm-hmm. Like, you saw each other. You're, like, both brown people. You have a lovely child now. Like, and you guys sit in bed and go, like, ah, fucking, you're Jessica's dating a honky. and for good reason, because you're like, you know what? It's fucking bullshit. Like, what I'm curious about is, like, are we... Like, are we doing this because we don't want ideology to, like, if it's like this thing, I don't want to, like, I don't want to okay, heat up too hot a button.
Sure, let me say. Okay, so Brittany Nichols and I actually have talked about this because she and I have both dated white people, and it's like, you know, but we're both very outspoken about issues of race, you know, and I come in here in this recording studio every week and talk about how shitty fucking white dudes are, and yet I go home to a white man, which Samir loves to remind me about. But the thing is, you know, Brittany, I mean, I don't want to speak for her, but she made a good point to people that when we were having this kind of discussion where she was saying, like, okay, but you have to understand, like that all comes from, like, the white supremacy of the world. Like, for we've grown up in a world where media tells us the standard of beauty and the standard of masculinity is a white...
And also the standard of sexual liberation.
Is a white man for, you know, or the standard of beauty for a woman is a white woman who, like, that's her features, everything about her. Like, that is the standard of beauty, a white person. And that's what we've been indoctrinated with since we were young. Like, you have to take that into account, too. Growing up in Western media, that's what we're told is the most desirable.
But well, I guess this is my drunken point, is that we're not shoving that down black men's throats in movies. And if this is a trope where we're talking about, like, one Crayola argument would be, well, they're kind of brown, they almost look Greek, let's suck them in. But it's like, if it were our unconscious goal to indoctrinate and assimilate, we would be promoting the fuck out of the idea of black men fucking white women, and we simply don't do it. Wait, just please. I just I'm wondering about, like, this is where this comes in, like the Islamophobia thing, where we characterize brown men, Islamic brown men. We leap to women's rights and sexuality. If you watch a Law and Order from before 1999, and this idea, like as a white guy, I'm coming away from pop culture with the idea that devout Islam has something is tied up in sexual frustration, and the subtext is, if they could just fuck one of our beautiful white women, they would just relax a little bit and they would be so happy.
That's interesting. I have never heard that before.
Now that I said that out loud, Jessica, sorry, you can go. Like, I just wanted to get my amazing Noam Chomsky point out. But I mean, I really, like to me, because it's like, think about it. Like, if the white agenda was, let's make everyone love whiteness, why wouldn't we shove that pill down black men's throats more than we do?
We shove it down everyone's throats because who do we uphold as the standard of beauty?
No, but we don't. We get.
Who is in media?
We get, like, to Samir's point.
Yeah.
Who is
on the cover of Sports Illustrated every year?
I don't know.
White women.
I'm saying, like, we have a reaction still to this day about the idea of black men and white women. We don't push it. And Samir is saying there's a tradition in white America of kind of pushing the brown men and white women thing. I'm taking fire on that.
So let's back up. So I think that anti-blackness is something that's very specific and a conversation that comes with very different tropes and history than the assimilation conversation of model minorities, because the interest in the country is an entirely different context. So I think the idea, for me at least, is that to your argument of, you know, would it make sense if, you know, white people said, hey, and, you know, embrace us by shoving this pill down their throat. I think that is white men's greatest fear, actually, right? That whether it's something that's been institutionalized or something that is, you know, psychologically premeditated, but that's why it would never happen, right? It's that great fear that these black men are going to take our white women. That's where that comes from. Birth of a Nation, etc. That same dialect hasn't really been made for the South Asian or East Asian male, somewhat with the yellow peril, but that was quickly altered very early on. So we were always seen as kind of, you know, the desexualized, you know, like, you know, granted, like, there is history of Chinese uprising, etc., in the context of, you know, white women being looked at, etc., but very much so, the way that we perceive this culture, South Asian, East Asian, comes from this brain drain idea, which is almost enveloped everything else, where we don't even think about the railroads.
Welcome to America. Your skin is olive to brown. Like, you're not black. Please partake of our Norwegian looking women and our Atari games, and like let this Ramadan thing go, and like please. That's our fantasy.
The idea is like, hey, like, you know, you're not creating a problem, so come hang with us, but you can't get into the VIP room.
Right.
For black folks, you are a problem. Yeah. So that's why it's different.
It's white guilt, and it's like almost genetic memory. Like, it's I wonder if it's just like, it is truly just Crayola mindset, where it's like, well, your skin is so dark. Are we really reacting to skin color, or are we, is skin color causing a cultural, artificially constructed thing in our head where we're if I look at a brown guy, why am I, as a white writer, going like, that dude needs to fuck a white woman? And if I look at a black guy, I'm like, well, I don't want to cause trouble. Maybe he should just fuck a beautiful black woman. Like, that's definitely worth hanging a big, giant Roman candle on. Let's not even figure it out. Let's put a fucking giant, that's what this podcast is about, put a fucking huge road flare on it. Be aware of it. Ask the question. Do you have opinions about this stuff? You at home, do you cringe when you think about certain complexions being with certain others? Are there ones where you go, yeah, that's a resolution to a story, that guy getting with that girl?
Yeah, because it's like, I feel like your issue isn't like, oh, let's never see a brown guy with a white woman. It's more like, why is it that
why is the airport terminal pointing towards that baggage carousel?
Why is all of the stories about brown men end with him with a white woman?
I mean, the simple answer being, no one wants to watch a movie about two brown people falling in love. That's this very, very simple answer. But however, we have just entered an era where we have proven that is not true. Black Panther. We are living in a post Black Panther world. Like, we don't give a fuck. Like if it's good enough, and we also have had a million movies that are like quote unquote for black people that white people can enjoy. That, but there's a deeper question here for a future episode, because we still don't. We've had a lot of waiting to exhales, and we have not had a lot of like, I'm black and you're white and let's kiss.
Can you write that movie, please? I'm black and you're white and let's kiss.
I mean, we're more comfortable with the idea of out and out fucking representation to the point of total autonomy than we are with misogyny. But then we're actually into misogyny with that. I'm trying to get on board this, like, noticing this thing.
By the way, I would love for the Christian designation of time, BC and AD, to now be like before Black Panther and after Black Panther. Like, let's start talking about the year as like ABP.
Yeah, we're at one right now.
Let's start over. We're ABP one.
All right. Well, anyway, so there's no way to. I mean, let's just keep Samir on your radar because he's actually like proactively doing crazy proactive shit.
Yeah, and he's also a pretty okay friend.
He's all right. I mean, I don't know why he's a forgiving friend, that's for sure. He's been friends with Jessica for this long.
For a dozen years.
It's your name on Twitter, which may be hard to spell for people like me.
Why don't you spell out your name on Twitter?
Sure. S-A-M, as in Mary, double E-R, Gardezi, G A R, D's and dog, E's and Ernie, Z's and zebra, I. And follow me. I have a pitiful following, like 1,000 or something. So
you may have a half dozen to 24 Nazis like that are following you that don't want to
get ready for 31-year-old Norwegian men to start fucking questioning your credentials.
But more importantly, I think people follow, because I mean, I think it's amazing that you're taking that bull by the horns, and like, I'd love it if you came back and like told us more when we can like also connect and help and anyway.
I wouldn't. Yeah. I never. Never want you back on this podcast again.
I want you to fail.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. This was really fun.
Stay racial.
It's a good show.